Welcome to We're Not Wizards. We are the best, but not wizards. Enjoy the show!
Welcome to another episode of We're Not Wizards. My name's Richard. I'll be your host for March. March is here. It's starting to get a little bit lighter. It's starting to get a little bit brighter. If you're across stateside, then you've already been forced to get out of bed with an hour less sleep because of the clocks changing. And over here, the clocks aren't changing for another couple of weeks. And they just happen to happen the same time that Easter Sunday's happening, which is not good, which means you technically get less time to eat your chocolate, but you do technically get your chocolate a little bit earlier, which is always good. I personally try and hide my chocolate because it's my chocolate, and if I don't hide my chocolate, then certain other members of my family get hold of it. You could say when it comes to chocolate, I often have a no-wife rule or even a no-girlfriend rule. And I thought I wanted to speak to somebody who maybe was a little bit of an expert in reference to no girlfriend rules. So I am joined by the rather wonderful, rather fantastic Kristen Randall, who has got a book out here called The No Girlfriend Rule, which is all about, it's all about role playing and Dungeons and Dragons and finding yourself and maybe finding somebody else at the same time. So hello, Kristen.
Hi.
How are you?
Thanks. I'm doing swell. Thank you so much for having me. I'm excited to chat.
Is this kind of like, because you see this all the time on kind of like the late night shows and stuff like that. Like over here, we've got like Jonathan Ross and Graham Norton and stuff like that, where you get the kind of the authors kind of coming on and having to do the tour and having to be like a media darling for a good couple of weeks and kind of be really polite and answer stupid questions, which will be coming from me. Is it a bit of a strange kind of situation at the moment for you?
Yes, especially as a person with anxiety, this has been an adventure. Every time that I do something like this, I love doing things like this.
Yeah.
But every time that I do something like this, my little anxiety goblin pops up and reminds me that I am an anxious person who wrote a book about a kid with anxiety. And so here we are doing the thing, but still anxious about it.
See, I've got this theory that people that always start podcasts, that what happens is after a while, you give them one podcast and it's almost like Kirsten Dunst's character in the Interview with a Vampire, is that you give them a little taste of podcasting and then they're just, I would like some more. And then the next thing, you know, you bump into them like a year and a half down the line and they reach into their bag and they hand the card and say, how are you, darling? You must listen to my podcast, which is now on its like 50th episode. So I think this is, I totally get where you're coming from, because I am, and I found this recently about myself, is I can be quite anxious myself. But the reason I like podcasting is because it's like a controlled environment. So I know where I am in terms of my boundaries. And unless somebody jumps out from behind the curtain or something, then I'm kind of, everything's going to be kind of okay.
Yeah. I'm getting, now that I'm kind of getting a little more comfortable with like the format of being interviewed, but it feels a little less foreign to be interviewed by people. I'm actually kind of enjoying it.
Yeah.
Even when those anxious feelings pop up. But it's fun to get to like hang out and talk about books and stuff and new stuff.
Especially talk about your own thing as well.
Yes.
That's always a bit of a kind of a strange thing, I find. I think it's like when you're having a general conversation, it's like, what do you think about novel writing? Is it easy or difficult? And you go, yeah. But when somebody says, well, what about your novel and writing it? How did you approach that? And you're like, oh, okay.
Suddenly I've forgotten everything I've ever done. Yeah.
Exactly.
Absolutely.
Exactly. Let's turn, because what we like to do in We're Not Wizards is we like to have, as I say, we like to have a look at the dungeon sheets of the past, before we look at the GM of the present and the adventures into the future. But as you were growing up, if I... this is going to sound... No. I maybe should rephrase this question while it's in my head right now. But if I sneaked into your room when you were younger, would I have found notebooks with lots and lots of... See, that didn't come out no matter which way I was going to say.
Parentheses, non-creepy way.
Yes.
Like, we can just, I'll just take on faith that you mean it in a creepy way.
Yes.
When we find notebooks full of, like, stories and, like,
yeah,
and stuff. Little,
yeah, yeah.
Yes, absolutely. Right. I've kind of been a lifelong nerd, and stories have always been the way that I interact with the world, that I process my own world. And it started with reading books, and then it progressed, I guess, naturally to, like, telling stories in my own head.
Yeah.
And then skipped right into writing stories. And so I constantly had, like, little goofy little notebooks and diaries filled with stories. Like, the margins of my notes in school would always be filled with stories and doodles and, like, little ideas. Even, like, my hobby growing up was, like, role-playing. Like, so forum role-playing.
Yeah.
I did a lot of, like, super nerdy writing back and forth with my friends. As soon as I realized that I could write stories like the ones that I was, reading, it was all over.
What would you say, when you were growing up, what kind of authors... were you always kind of diving into? What did you kind of love picking up and reading when you were younger?
The first series that I remember reading, so I, brief caveat, I have dyslexia.
Right.
Which is like a learning disability that makes it hard for you to learn how to read. So I actually was, reading growing up was really challenging for me, but I absolutely loved stories. And when I finally got comfortable with reading, like, on my own, I was in about, like, third, fourth grade, and the first series I remember reading and really loving, I'm probably going to say wrong because I'm dyslexic and I never hear it said out loud, are the Pyr Dane Chronicles by Lloyd Alexander.
Right.
Like, the Book of Three, the Black Cauldron. I loved that, like, fantasy world. I loved that there was, like, a princess who was part of the adventuring party for them. I was also really obsessed with, like, Catherine Called Birdie and The Midwife's Apprentice. Like, all of these books that I ended up picking up at my school's book fair became, like, my ride-or-die books. And they were all kind of fantasy, like, medieval Renaissance festival vibes with girl characters kind of front and center.
Yeah, yeah. I was... Pratchett always hit me at a good age. Because I was only probably about... I was probably about 16, 17 when the first Terry Pratchett book kind of came out. Before then, it was jumping about a whole kind of different thing. It was really weird because I was more of a comic person than ever a book person. And it took a while for books, the kind of books that I was looking to read, to kind of align. But also, we didn't have... You didn't have the big chain of bookstores as well. So we did, we had a, like, where I came from, we had, like, one big huge bookstore, which was called Macpherson's. But there wasn't, like, chains of them. It's not like nowadays where you've got, like, Barnes & Noble kind of everywhere or Waterstones and everywhere.
There I was going to say Waterstones, yeah.
Very, very kind of selective where the kind of the books were. So I do remember doing an awful lot of reading with the Final Fantasy books, like your Steve Jackson, Ian Livingston kind of books. And I remember the... at the time, people going, well, that's not, it's kind of not reading, you're kind of gaming at the same time. But it was kind of like that kind of fantasy kind of element.
Yeah.
But you were kind of role playing at the same time, kind of more kind of like in your head. And then they went to Epic. They started off with the single games, like, you know, this, I think Starship Traveler was one. There was a road, like almost like a road game. A Road Rash type game or something like that, where it was like set in the future, like Mad Max world, and there was all these different things. But then they brought out like Crown of Kings, which was like a four set of big books, and I just remember kind of like devouring them and people going, well, they're not really, really books because you've got dice rolls and dice, you're playing, you're rolling with dice. So that kind of, that fantasy kind of thing in the background was always something I got. I jumped into a bit of Stephen King. And I like Stephen King, but I like Stephen King not because of the horror, because I remember picking up Clive Barker and reading some of his books of blood stuff and going, oh my, oh dear, no, and putting it down.
Yeah.
But the thing I always liked about King, and I think some of the things that people forget about King, is he's very, very good at writing kind of very, very human characters. that you kind of absolutely kind of identify with. And then going forward, I got into comics, and then finally kind of Pratchett appeared round about when I was 16, 17, 18. So that's where kind of I kind of came from. But at the same time that you were, you mentioned kind of like role-playing. So was it kind of like the, was it D&D or was it other kind of systems that you kind of played as well?
So it's like even, I think maybe not deeper nerd, but it's definitely a nerdier kind of nerd. The kind of, when I was a kid and into my teens, the kind of role-playing that I did before I even found like tabletop role-playing was like forum role-playing. So it was literally just like full-on nerd, like two people on the internet writing stories back and forth to one another. So I would write, my character did this thing and da-da-da-da-da, like in this like sandbox world that we were playing. Like just full-on deep nerd stuff. But that's how I caught my storytelling teeth, because I had to learn how to write really engaging characters that somebody would want to like waste hours of their day writing back and forth with. It's how I cut my writing teeth, because I always wanted to like write a more exciting post or like really make my writing friends like excited to read what I was writing. But yeah, it's definitely, I think even a step nerdier than D&D was even back in the day. Cause I didn't start playing tabletop until like, high school age.
Right. Okay.
Yeah.
But when you were doing the writing stuff, was there certain tools, because you mentioned the dyslexia, was there certain tools that you kind of brought in to help you overcome the dyslexia, or was there things that you had to kind of, did you just have to kind of get on with it and kind of learn as best as you could?
Yeah. So I think unfortunate for younger Kristen answer is that I just kind of had to white knuckle through it. I grew up going to private school, which I think is different from private school over there, but it's like, it's a non-public school, and there's not as much, like special education support in those schools, or there wasn't then. I don't know about now. So I didn't really have a lot of like in-school support. I had, a wonderful tutor who helped me outside of school, but I just had to, find workarounds that worked for me while I was like, when I was physically writing things. And I think one of the ways that you can't overcome dyslexia. It's just part of my brain.
Yeah.
But one of the ways that I learned to live with it and to interact with it was probably writing so much, like, just growing up.
You get different levels of dyslexia. So was it a case that do you find like you're reading over stuff kind of more and more just to double check? Because I guess stuff that you've written, especially if you were doing this kind of like forum kind of adventuring, you're sending it to people and hoping that they get the kind of the context or understand completely what you're getting. So did it take long, because you're writing effectively for a captive audience, were you then checking things kind of more? Or did they come to accept that little mistakes would kind of sneak through, and it wasn't that you'd made the mistakes, it was just one of these things?
I call them my Kristenisms. There's certain things that I'm always just like, I never, even now, and I do this professionally and I have a wonderful team who helps me, like there's some typos that I'm just never going to catch because my brain automatically just on its own flips like letters around a lot, especially when it comes to vowels. Like there are certain things that I'm just never going to be able to get right or even notice that I haven't gotten right. But yeah, I mean, it taught me to be careful. I had to learn grammar and stuff as I was doing this. And so it was just like a really nerdy non-school lesson in writing and like using my brain to create fun things.
Was there things that you brought in? Did you always have like a kind of a side kind of palette of ideas that you would bring in regularly? Did you say, I'd like to introduce this, I'd like to introduce that? And did you bring it in? Or was a lot of it, are you the type of person that I could say, okay, we're going to be doing this, and you could come up with like 15 ideas, just one after another? Or are you more of a planner?
I'm a little bit of both of those, I guess. I love the way that I wrote then and the way that I write now is I start with characters. Mm-hmm. I care about writing good characters that people connect with. I care about writing characters that people feel seen by. Mm-hmm. And that I just really enjoy writing. So I always start with characters and I'm like, okay, this is the character that I have. This is the story I think that they need to tell. Mm-hmm. And then within the parameters of the greater story that we were telling, I would like roll with the ideas. Mm-hmm. And I think I'm pretty good at generating a whole bunch of ideas. Sometimes I think to my team's dismay in publishing, because I'm the kind of person who's like, oh, you want ideas? Here's about 50 of them.
Yeah.
sorry. Like I throw every piece of spaghetti at the wall and see which ones stick. But yeah, I think I'm a little bit of both. And I think that carries over now too. I'm very much an ideas person. I think to get to a level where I can do this professionally now, I've had to kind of become a planner. Like I've had to kind of, build the infrastructure for myself to be able to do that. Cause that is, I don't think very naturally how my brain works, but it's how I'm able to do what I do now.
So when you were at school, did you then, what was your kind of your education then? Did you stay all the way through high school? Did you then go to college? I mean, what was your kind of your path from there? Yeah.
So I went to, like, I just went through elementary, middle, high school. I was one of those, I was a gifted kid. I don't know. Do you all have that over there? Where, like, the kids who are, like, who are high achieving and, like, good grades and often are a little bit of, like, a troublemaker, that are smart and get bored. I was one of those kids. Yeah. And so I did really, really, I kicked butt all the way up through high school. And just like, if I was into a class, I was getting 100, like an A+ in it.
Yeah.
If I was not into a class, I was getting like a C and I was cocky about it.
Yeah.
I was a terrible student. But I also had undiagnosed ADHD. Wow. So when I got to college and that structure of traditional schooling was removed and I had to be the structure, I floundered.
Yeah.
Just like totally flopped, and had no idea. Like, I used to be able to do this all the time last year when I was in high school. Why can't I do this now?
Yeah.
And I really flopped. It was just not a good structure for me. And so I didn't finish my English degree in college. I tried twice and flunked out twice. But now I get to do what I love anyway, because I write all the time. So
it's like I don't need this piece of paper that you claim I needed to get this kind of piece of paper. I do find it. I think that, not that, I mean, there seems to be a kind of a push not to label people, but I think there's a kind of a push to kind of look at the kind of the ADHD stuff and look at the autism stuff. And I know some people that struggle moving from, like, what you would call lower school up to kind of high school. And that's because they're used to being in one class with one teacher, and then when they go to high school, they're flipping between classes as they go to different subjects. And I know kids that really struggle with that. I know kids that if they've got ADHD, they love that because they know exactly that they have to be on Tuesday at 10 a.m. They have to be sitting in English for 40 minutes, and that's their class, and they're kind of sorted it out. And all of a sudden, if for some reason that class gets disrupted or whatever, they get lost. So when they go to university, like you said, it's a case of, well, you now only get a class at 10 o'clock, your next class isn't until 2 o'clock, and your class after that isn't until 12:30 the next day for 4 hours. And it's like, and then it's like,
and then you're also, the thing that got me is that I was the adult who was supposed to be enforcing that for myself. Yeah. It was over. Yeah, just could not do that. But absolutely, that was the case with me.
Yeah. So what drove you to kind of start the degree? Was there a parental influence? I mean, are they both kind of like academics in terms of
yes, they are now. So my parents actually they went to college. Uh-huh. Like my mom was the first person in her family to go to college.
Uh-huh.
They are both theater majors.
Right.
So drama runs in the fam. They actually
runs in most families.
Well, it's professional in my family.
Wow.
They, like, my dad worked in television for a long time. Okay. But they have now, later in life, they have both ended up becoming teachers.
Right.
And I can blame my high school teachers for making me love English. And I went to school to do an English degree.
Uh-huh.
But yeah, no, I was, I guess, like a stereotypical, like, dramatic, emotional queer teen in the United States. I was like really close with my English teachers in high school and really loved them. And they cared about me, which was really fun and cool. And I just kind of like found my love of words. I guess I didn't find my love of words. I figured that I could do something with my love of words because of their influence. And actually, at my book launch in Nashville, the other day, my high school English teacher came and cheered me on for my book launch. Yeah, Mr. Stackhouse. Hi, Mr. Stackhouse.
That's so cool. Yeah. I know he listens to the show. So that
I know, I'm sure, yes.
Well, you better tell him to listen to the show.
I will.
You
know what I mean?
Could you, just because you can say, well, you get a shout out. He gets a shout out
in the book, too. I love him so much that Hollis's favorite teacher in the book is Mr. Stackhouse. Okay. Mr. Stackhouse version in the book is he's an art teacher and not an English teacher, but I wanted to give him a shout out because he's just so good.
So you mentioned you're getting kind of your English teachers were really strong in the kind of the support kind of thing. In terms of nowadays, I think there's a little bit more support in terms of people's kind of identities, sexualities and stuff like that as well. When you were growing, well, I mean, when I was growing up, it was, you know, it didn't exist. well, you know, when you were growing up, was it still something that was kind of like, I am feeling, I know who I am, but I'm not sure I should be telling everybody else who kind of I am as a person kind of thing?
Yeah, so I was kind of on the cusp of the transformation that we've seen, I think, in terms of people accepting identity.
Mm-hmm.
Like I was in school when a lot of like the big like legal decisions were going through here in the United States. For me personally, I have always known that I'm queer.
Mm.
But I grew up in the American South, which is not a very comfortable place to be queer even still. But definitely not in the year of our Lord 2005 when I was like a cool teenager. And I was not super comfortable with my identity, but still, I think the power of being a queer person is that we are just like drawn to one another.
Mm-hmm.
And like most of my community as a teen and like into my early 20s were all of my wonderful queer friends. Who were just like side-eyeing me and sure-janning me when I was like, I'm just a really passionate ally. Like, I'm fighting for the cause as an ally. And it was not until like I had like a girlfriend and like I went to like the gay bar and I was still like, I'm just an ally who loves to kiss girls. I'm just really, really passionate about what I do.
I'm a method actor here.
I was exactly. Yeah. And I was just so like in my head about like, well, this is, I do these things, but this is not like I'm straight. I've got to be straight.
Yeah.
So lost in the heteronormative sauce. But it wasn't really until like my mid-20s that I like finally came out to myself. And have had wonderful support from my friends.
I think that's a big thing, isn't it? I think I think it's really funny because there's kind of like a big there's obviously the big, huge backlashes as people get naturally want to be scared and desire some kind of enemy. That's, you know, when it's obvious what's causing everything to not be great, and they decide to invent some kind of enemy that's causing it to not be great. And America seems to be kind of hating on everything except the actual things that it probably should kind of hate, which is kind of weird. And I see it kind of going. I see it kind of going backwards instead of just normalize. Because normally what happens is there's usually a big leap and folk go, this is now accepted. And it's like, okay, cool. And then everything kind of stabilizes and normalizes on like a straight, straight line. Wrong saying.
Mm-hmm.
But you know what I mean? And then there's the next big jump. But it seems to be the case that people are like going, no, we like it back here. When we could make our little jokes and stuff like that and everything was cool and we're not happy to kind of go up to the next level. And America seems to be going, but I see they're trying to do this over here in the UK as well. There seems to be a bit of a push, and I'm not sure who it's for or what it's going to achieve and stuff like that. And it generally confuses me, you know. I take it you're in a space now where it's kind of like, I am who I am, what I am, where I am, why I am. And was that one of the reasons, obviously we've got the theme of the book, which we'll go into, but was that one of the reasons that you said, well, actually, I'm going to write about characters that I not only, when I look in the mirror, I see this character. but also hopefully when other people read the book, they'll also see that character as well, and they'll see a reflection of themselves.
Yes, absolutely. So I didn't start writing characters like me until like my early 30s.
Mm-hmm.
And honestly, there's a lot of parts of myself that I didn't love until my early 30s. I didn't become comfortable with being a fat person until my early 30s.
Mm-hmm.
And I spent so much of my time growing up, like in my teens and in my 20s, just hating myself for being wrong, quote unquote, for not being this or that. And now that I'm on the other side of that and just love myself for who I am and excited to share who I am with the world, I want to, if I can be the voice for someone who is younger than me, like who picks up the book and sees that it's okay to be all of these things, it's okay to be queer and fat and anxious all at the same time,
mm-hmm.
and maybe steps into self-love a little bit earlier than I was able to, I will be the happiest author in the world. Like, that's why I do this thing. I definitely write the books that I wish that I had growing up, and if the kids who need them or the young folks who need them find this and can step into self-love earlier, I've done my job.
Yeah, I mean, that's what it, I mean, it's everybody's got a kind of a message or a story they kind of want to tell. And sometimes it's not, when you're putting something out there for other people to read, you don't always realize if it's going to resonate with anyone at all. But sometimes if it resonates with just one person, then it's like, okay, I've done my job. If it makes somebody feel better about themselves, or kind of like go, oh, this is actually fine, or this is cool, or okay, so it is shitty just now, but it is going to kind of get better, then, and kind of helps them on their way. And I think that's another thing about kind of mainstream media. I find there's a bit of people kind of going, well, I don't like this because I don't like this new bit of media that's out there because it's not written with me in mind. And it's like, yeah, no, but that's because you're just not the be all and end all nowadays. And it seems to be a bit of a backlash about that. But how did this story come about? Because I'm not going to read it because, well, I could, but it's all about Hollis Beckwiths on a quest to find their place in the world of tabletop gaming. So how much of this did it write itself, and how much of this was kind of like, well, I'm actually basing this off my own kind of experiences?
It definitely is a fictional story informed by my lived experience.
Right.
So I did not have an epic girl squad that I played D&D with in high school and stuff. But I've got that now as an adult, and it's wonderful. But it's definitely like, I wanted to be able to tell a self-love story. I wanted to be able to tell like a fun romance story. Yeah. And I loved the idea. So I love tabletop. I feel like we've established that. I love tabletop role playing.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the things that I love about it so much is that it provides this really unique sort of safe space to explore your identity and to imagine things about yourself that you might not be able to imagine. Like, you can put on a character and you can imagine having a silly voice or being a boy or being upper class or whatever. And you can imagine all of these things, but you can also imagine like
being a wizard.
It gives you this wonderful, but it gives you this wonderful safe space to kind of explore these ideas and also your identity. And I loved the idea of using a tabletop role-playing game as a vehicle for that, because role-playing has kind of been the heart of the story of finding out who you are with the aid of role-playing has definitely been something that has happened to be in my life.
Uh-huh.
And so I've created this fun little like romance coming of age story with that at the heart of it.
Did you, I mean, in the book you say that it was difficult to actually go into role-playing groups where there wasn't a lot of girls present or women present. Did you find that if you were kind of going to specific groups, you felt maybe not as welcome as you'd have liked to have been?
Absolutely. And I think that something that I have encountered as the book has come up, as bumping into the world now, is that that is a very familiar experience to a lot of like women and femme readers of the book. Definitely in my teens when I was role-playing, I was the only girl in my group.
Mm-hmm.
But even into my adulthood, there's this, the first scene of the book is the world, like the worst game of secrets and sorcery ever played.
Yeah.
And that is directly inspired by a real game of D&D that I played in my own local gaming store back when I was living in Nashville. I was an adult then, and that was not terribly long ago. That was like, gosh, how many years ago now? I guess it was like 10 years ago. I'm old. But I mean, like, it was in the most recent edition of D&D, so it's not like ages and ages ago. And unfortunately, I think geek spaces and tabletop spaces have not always been the most inclusive. And so it's been a real joy to kind of create a counter narrative to ideas like the no girlfriend rule. Like, well, my girlfriend can't play in my D&D game because it's just for us guys. Mm-hmm. And tell this wonderful story about a bunch of girls coming together and playing this really epic, wonderful story and finding like joy and like community within the game as a bunch of girls.
Did it write itself then? When, I mean, once you had the kind of the idea together, was it a fun book to write? Because I know some people that when they're writing stuff, it's like, how are you getting on? It's like, I managed 3 lines today in my life. My life sucks. I hate it all. But I need to keep going with it because I got the advance for the book. And, you know, if I don't finish it, then I'm in a lot of trouble.
Yeah.
But was it a kind of a like, yeah, and I remember this and I remember that. So was it almost a bit cathartic to kind of write it, to get it kind of out there and down?
Yeah. I mean, there was not a single day when I was doing my first draft of this book that I didn't have a great time.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if it's so much wrote itself as that it just brought me so much joy to write it that I was happy to get it. I mean, like, I drafted it in a month and a half for the first draft that I ever did of it. Yeah. And it was a big baby back then, too. It has been cut down significantly to under 100,000 words.
Yeah.
But my first draft of this book was like 120,000 words, which is just stupid long. And it really did just kind of like come out of me. Because I've been wanting to tell a story like this for a long time, but I wasn't brave enough. Because there's definitely, while the story is fun and joyful, some of the emotional beats were really hard to get out. Like having to really examine some of Hollis's story, and especially some of the experiences we share, like being a fat person,
mm-hmm.
being an anxious person.
Mm-hmm.
Some of that was very challenging to put on the page. But overall, it was just, I had the best time writing this book.
Was there parts when you were reflecting on yourself that you were kind of like, you had to stop for a second and it kind of brought back memories and stuff that maybe weren't the most pleasant memories to have as well?
Yeah, I mean, I think the way that I write is I create fictional stories based on experiences that I've had, or not even based on, inspired by it. I stitch little things together.
Yeah.
So definitely when I was going through, there's a couple of emotional beats that are spoilers that I can't say for folks that haven't read the book yet.
Okay.
That were so hard to write that I had to like go on. So like the way that I deal with things, the way that I noodle things out when I get really stuck is I go on these like big long walks.
Yeah.
So there's like, there's at least one really hard scene towards the end of the book that I had to go on many, many big long walks about to get out. Like, I'm like just like walking through the neighborhood, listening to like the playlist that I had for this book and like crying in public. Definitely there were several of those. But yeah, no, like, of course, the way that I write characters, I write people. And so, of course, it's emotional work to get the hard bits out.
Because one of the things, it's interesting you said you cut it back, because, I mean, I write a lot. I write reviews. I like to think I write. But it's also, I think it's almost like board game design. It's like when it's your own product, when it's your own baby, you put everything on the table and you're mixing broccoli with sweet corn and carrots and mushrooms, and you've got a side bit of bacon and you've got some toast and then you've got some scones and then you've got a gravy bowl and then you've got like a half pint of juice, and somebody has to come along and say, this all looks great, but the garlic mayonnaise and the ranch sauce on the side and the pizza,
we can deal without base one of those, but yeah,
maybe just a little bit kind of too much. So in terms of the writing process, do you generally just write everything kind of down and then strip it back, or do you kind of edit as you kind of go in terms of kind of stripping things out?
I have to get everything out at once.
Right.
Maybe it's anxiety, maybe it's the neurodiversity, but I really struggle with, if I allow myself to edit as I go, I convince myself very quickly that everything I'm writing is garbage and I hate it.
Oh, right.
And okay. I'll stop. Mm-hmm. So I like to get everything out in one go, and then take stuff out after, mm-hmm. just so that I have stuff to take out. You know what I mean? Because yeah. if I don't get it all out, I won't have anything to edit at the end of the day. So I, much like I am in life, I throw every piece of spaghetti at the wall and see what sticks.
Are you then using, again, going back to the dyslexia then, are you using additional tools to help you whether you're right? I mean, sometimes, depending on how I'm feeling, I might open up Notepad, open up Google, and then just start talking away just to get kind of like a general structure and bullet points, and then go back and edit it. Do you ever use anything like that, or are you just typing away from the beginning and just...
Yes, to both. Again, I keep saying that, I feel like, but I write stuff in phases. So I have like a big kind of brain dump phase before I start doing the actual like chapter one kind of thing. And I, for like, ideally for like a month, I spend a whole month of just putting down every idea that I have, whether it's character or plot or setting or like literally whatever, into a big dump doc. And that is very much like, I'll be taking the bus to work and I have to like pull out my phone and like be the weird person on the bus giving myself a voice note to listen to later. Or like I've pulled over on the side of the road before and like typed stuff out to myself, or like just jot stuff down on post-it notes. So at that phase, very much it's all like everything all the time, like just like throw everything into the pot.
Is that to do a little bit with ADHD? Because what I find is like my memory, I'll have flashes of absolute brilliance and say, I really need to include this kind of word or this kind of phrasing in this review. And it's like, unless, if I don't go and write that phrasing down right away, then I'll come back to it kind of like an hour later and go, what was that I was going to say? It was probably the best line of English I've ever written in my life, and now it's kind of gone. But you know what I mean? It's kind of like that kind of, it's not like a short, it's not even short-term memory loss. It's almost a case of, here's an idea, it's like a firework, and unless you grab it or look at it right again, you turn away and it's kind of gone and it's kind of faded.
Absolutely that.
How long did it take you to kind of go from first draft to saying, right, I'm finished? And at what point did you say, actually, I'm going to start pitching this to people to see who's kind of interested in taking it kind of forward?
So my experience is a little bit atypical. So I wrote it, and then I had to learn how to revise, because this is the first book that I've ever actually tried to do anything with.
Right.
It's really the first book that I ever wrote. I had drafted directly before this an absolutely garbage new adult romance that will never see the light of day.
It will
do. But I, like, yeah, I, it's awful. But this is the first book that I ever was like, okay, I know I need to revise this. Yeah. So I had to learn what revision is and like how to do it and what is the right way, and then learn that there is no right way. So I did all of that. And then, I applied for a mentorship program, which is like a cool, they're fading now, which makes me sad. But for a while, there was kind of a boom on the internet of author mentorship programs. So I had polished up the manuscript as best as I could on my own, threw my name to the hat for this mentorship through Write Team Mentorship Program, and got matched up with a wonderful author named Johnny Garzavia. They're amazing. You should read everything that they ever write. And then we kind of did like a training version of what querying looks like. So we worked, or like what having an agent looks like. So they worked with me to do a revision on the book. They worked with me to get my query letter in shape. And we did all of that. And then I started querying. I queried for about 7 months.
When you mean what do you mean by querying? Is that approaching publishing?
Yes, sorry. I forget not everybody knows this like ridiculously specific jargon that I have to know as an author.
That's why I'm querying, asking. Yeah.
Yes, thank you. Yeah. Querying is the process of sending your manuscript to agents.
Right.
So after you've gotten your manuscript in the best state that you can,
yeah,
you write this very specialized kind of letter that pitches your books to agents. And then you send them out into the world. And some people will like get requests from agents. Some people just cold query agents. I did a little bit of both. I did some like pitch contests on Twitter back when it was still Twitter and like did good stuff.
Yeah.
And I actually connected with my agent that I ended up signing with, Becca Langton at Darley Anderson Children's, on Twitter through a Twitter pitch event, which is not the common experience at all.
Yeah.
So, like, she requested my book. She read it overnight. She, like, offered the next day. And it kicked off this flurry of, like, it felt very, like, super nerdy spy novel vibes. Because I was, like, on the fly, I was notifying everybody who had the book, like, oh, I've got an offer of representation. And, like, emailing back and forth and, like, getting all of these requests and stuff. Very cool moment. I ended up getting two other offers of representation, but I signed with Becca because she's amazing. And then we got to revise again. And so I revised it with Becca the same way that I had with Johnny. And then we sent it out on submission, which is the fancy publishing term for your agent sending the book to editors at publishing houses. And then we got an offer, which is wonderful. And I think all told, between the time that I started drafting the book in April of 2020, and I got my book deal in July of 2022.
Wow.
So like a year and a half-ish, right? Is the math mathing?
That's is that not pretty quick?
That's like two, it is really, really quick. The longest part for me was being in the querying trenches. Querying is so hard and it's only getting more difficult. So mad love out there to my author pals in the query trenches. But yeah, it has been kind of like this unexpected, like, I feel like a unicorn sometimes. Because there are people who spend like years and years and years and years doing this. There are, of course, people who like do the whole process in a couple of months. But like it's at every phase of this for me, it has just kind of, I have been very lucky to connect with the people that I need to connect with.
Was it luck or was it fate?
Bit of both.
Because I see people talking, I even say, oh, I'm lucky because I get to speak to certain people. Mm-hmm. But then it's like, well, you don't realize all the conversations that I have where I haven't spoken to people or something's gone wrong or it's kind of mucked up or something like that as well. And I find that, was there a sense of validation from your side when getting signed with a literary agent, first of all, try and say that three times fast, and then actually getting the publishing deal? Was it like an almost like a Star Wars Return of the Jedi Admiral Akbar sitting back when the Death Star kind of blew up, kind of going, you know, that'll do. That was good.
So like, yes, absolutely. This is honestly, like, I've always known that I wanted to be an author, but I never even had the audacity to think that I could maybe do this until I started doing it. So yes, like, it's absolutely a validation of like dream come true kind of moment.
Yeah.
It is also so strange. Like, as you're growing up, people are like, follow your dreams, chase your dreams. And then when they start coming true, there's kind of this moment of like, okay, now what? Like, I've worked and worked and worked towards this goal. Yeah. And then like, okay, like now check.
Yeah.
Like, what comes after the check mark? But luckily in publishing, it's just a wonderful, like a whole campaign of following the next check mark that you need to make. So yeah, you just keep going and you celebrate the victories when you get them, and then you write the next book.
And are they asking about the next book, or have you already planned the kind of the next book? Because one of the things I noticed for the while, and I think it was born out of It was born out of the Harry Potter series and Eragon, and I mean, anyone like that, is all of a sudden people were looking for, yeah, we don't just want one book from you, we want a kind of entire series of books from you. So when you sat down and when was and then when it got published, were they kind of saying, so what have you got next? What other irons have you got sitting in the fire? Where's your second, third, fifth, 19th yes. manuscript kind of thing?
Yeah. So, yes, when I got my book deal, it was for a 2-book deal.
Yeah.
So I already have another book under contract with my publisher in the US and my publisher in the UK, which is really, really great.
Yeah.
Yes. We have kind of in publishing in general, I think we're kind of moving away from the, like, we want a bazillion book series.
Yeah.
And especially I write YA contemporary. So like standalones are kind of like the thing. So the next book that I have is not in the same, it's not a continuation of Hollis's story. It is in sort of the same version of Covington where Hollis lives, if that makes sense.
Yeah, so no, like, absolutely not. I mean, as I say, alluding back to Stephen King, I mean, he talks about Maine and Bangor and Maine and stuff like that. All, you know, he talks about Derry and on all these different places, and he cross-references characters and something like that. So I think, you know, it's cool to see, if you're doing a second book, if it's set in the same world, you're setting that same boundary, and it allows you to kind of go wherever you want with that particular kind of character set if you want, you know.
Yeah, yeah. And I can't talk too much about it yet because it's still secret. I'm doing my secret fingers.
But, in an audio podcast.
In my audio, let's use our imagination. Let's just wiggly jazz fingers. Those are my secret fingers. So it's still secret. But I'm really excited about it. There may or may not be like a cameo from one of the characters from the No Girlfriend Rule. So
you're already spoiling it.
That little bit, yeah. But I'm really excited. It's another queer young adult romance, and this one has on purpose neurodivergent characters. So I'm really excited about it.
Is it kind of cool? I mean, are you looking for? And I discovered this recently about Reese Witherspoon. What they generally used to do is like they would cover kind of books on their podcast, and then they would get the rights for the books, and then they would turn them into kind of films. So are you kind of
I would love that. I think that the No Girlfriend Rule would make a great like little series on Netflix or Amazon, don't you? Just like, because each game could be its own little episode. Like, I think it would be really great. Reese, give me a call.
I think you've got...
She's from Nashville, I'm from Nashville.
I think you've got Secrets and Sorcery, kind of like, you've got the kind of like the standalone kind of adventure kind of thing. Because that's a big space. I think it's really strange because Dungeons & Dragons, talking about Dungeons & Dragons anyway, there's a lot of people that love Dungeons & Dragons, but there's an awful lot of people that are always looking for little branches of stuff that's different, stuff that kind of maybe plays the same but also kind of plays different as well, because they want to play their kind of story. So there is obviously the option, there is the kind of the option to be able to kind of do that. For a while, and I saw this because of my job, is Amazon seemed to be doing the self-publisher book, and I don't know if that is still something that goes on as much, but it doesn't seem to be something that kind of goes on as much. And it's normally for the kind of the get rich quick kind of people.
I do not know anything about self-publishing at all. I have had to learn traditional publishing and I do not know anything about self-publishing.
Tying it back to the kind of like the tabletop space, there are some people who go through the crowdfunding route where they'll basically source and they'll manufacture the game themselves. And then there's some, you could say, designer developers that they'll approach companies and pitch to them to kind of get the book kind of picked up. You being in the situation where you are and you claiming to be kind of lucky and everybody else knowing that's not the case, is there tips that you would give to people, kind of, because because there's that old thing, where'd you get your ideas from? It's like, I don't know, I just, you know, I wake up at 3 o'clock in the morning screaming into the night and, you know, write down the first thing I saw. But is there tips that you would give to people who are sitting there going, well, that's fine, but, you know, they sound like they've got a kind of a good work ethic, or they sound like they had the right person at the right time, or when Twitter wasn't a cesspit, that could have happened to me kind of thing. But is there kind of tips that you would give people who are sitting there going, I'm 317 pages into my 407 page novel and I'm just, you know, I don't know what I'm meant to be doing next. Is there any advice you would give people like that?
Yeah, absolutely. Like a specific advice, I think, is best like searched out, but my just blanket coverall advice is just to have the audacity to keep going. Because yes. there are so many places on this like journey to being published where it is so much easier to quit. And if you just bet on yourself, if you just, I know that sounds so corny, but if you like believe in mm-hmm. yourself and you keep going, you have the chance to make it, to do it. And a big part of that for me in having the audacity to keep going is finding my people. Like, and again, I know that sounds like so dorky, no. but like reach out, connect with folks, like be brave and like slide into my DMs, you know, like if you have a publishing question, get at me, get yeah. like the wonderful thing about authors is that like by and large, we're all just kind of faking it till we make it. There are some lucky few who just like come from these like publishing dynasty families.
Yeah.
But like 85%+ of folks are just like figuring it out as we go. Mm-hmm. But if you just reach out and if you have that moment of vulnerability where you ask for help that mm-hmm. you need, I have been lucky to find, and I think that many people will be lucky to find, that authors are so willing to, if you're serious and yeah. if you're respectful and cool and like you really want to do the thing, people will reach back down the ladder and help pull you up. I have been incredibly lucky, I know, in my career that people have been willing to reach back down the ladder and help pull me up. And now it's my turn to get to do that. And yeah, I'm really yeah. excited to start being able to do that.
Is it strange having to do the marketing side of things, as in doing podcasts like this, kind of doing live event streams and stuff like that? When you were writing the book, do you think, oh, well, one day I'm going to be appearing on a podcast with a strange Scottish person? That's my goal. Is it on a post-it note somewhere with a tick box?
It was. It's right here. Yeah. No, absolutely. So writing is obviously a very solitary act. It's not just like a group activity yeah. where we all sit down and are like, okay, we're going to write a novel now.
Yeah.
I never anticipated doing this kind of stuff. It's just something that I never thought about. I have been delighted to be able to do it, though. I don't think I'm naturally like inclined to do this sort of thing, but it's really fun and cool. And again, it's kind of like I'm learning as I go how to do all of these things. But it's important to me as a like fat queer person mm-hmm. to be like visibly fat and queer and like be out there so that other people who are like me are like, oh, if Kristen Randall can do this, maybe I can do this.
Yeah.
So no, I really love this part. I didn't expect to. I didn't even expect to be able to do any of this, but it's so much fun.
Good stuff. That's great. The book is out just now. There's a bit of buzz about it. It's been in the US. Is it USA Today?
It's the USA Today bestseller list. Yes, it was number 109 out of 150. And you know what? I will take it.
That's fine.
yeah.
That's fine.
I was so surprised and so like just happy and amazed that it listed.
That's cool. And I take it it's available from all good, bad, and indifferent bookshops.
Wherever you buy your books, here in the US or in the UK.
Or in the UK.
You can buy a copy of The No Girlfriend Rule.
Excellent. If people have listened along tonight and they want to find out more about you, where you exist on the internet webs, where do you exist on the internet webs? Where can we find you?
On the internet webs, you can find me at my website, which is bykristenrandall.com,
mm-hmm.
and on most social media, but most actively on what used to be Twitter, Instagram, and TikTok, as long as we still have it, at bycrandall.
Oh yeah, you've got a bill going on at the moment to decide whether or not they're actually going to kick it out.
Yeah, literally, that's just like Yeah, I don't think Book Talk is going to go gentle into that good night, honestly. But, you know, we'll see what happens.
I think there'll be burning of senators if that happens. But
it's going to be a mess.
We will, of course, make sure that we put all of the all of those links in the show notes so that we've got notes to show. If you want to keep an eye on what we're up to, then go to the internet webs and search for We Are Not Wizards, and you'll find us in all the different faces, places, worn out, bright and early for the daily races, on just everywhere. Search for We Are Not Wizards, you'll find us. If you want to read what we've written, probably not in such a good way as Kristen's done, you can go to wearenotwizards.co.uk. And if you want to listen to other previous podcasts, you can go to wearenotwizards.com. And if you like what you've listened to, please go to your podcast catcher of choice and give us a rating or a review. And as we say, if you are going to be giving us a rating or a review, don't give us 10 stars because it makes, well, it makes me big headed, but don't give us 1 star because it makes us cry. Give me something in the middle, like a 5, because it's average, and I'm just a little bit average. But the person who's not being average is rather wonderful, rather fantastic, Kristen Randall. Thank you very much for guesting.
Thank you so much for having me.
Now, I've only got 2 more questions. The first question is, well, I guess to remember that we're many things, but we're not wizards. Are we wizards, Kristen?
We are not wizards.
Ways. Wonderful. And the second thing is to say goodbye. So it's a goodbye from Kristen. Say goodbye, Kristen.
Goodbye.
And it's a goodbye from me. Remember, stay safe, roll sixes, make something awful. And if you're wanting to read something slightly different, where it's not D&D, but it's a bit of secret and sorcery, and you're interested in finding out what are the rules behind the girlfriend's rule, then give it a look. But until the next time, goodbye.
A wizard is never licked. Is he early? He arrives precisely when he means to.